Sometimes what appears to be a dead end is not the end at all, but the beginning of a whole new realm. Welcome, everyone. I'm McDaniel Phillips, and this is Times of Refreshing, a ministry of Bethesda Hall in partnership with TWR Asia. Kenneth Wong is our host. He's an author, teacher, and itinerant speaker. Well, in the first two programs of his series, Ken has given us examples of choices people make when they come to a crossroads in life. Which way to turn? Do they turn to the right or to the left? They have to make a decision which can have far-reaching consequences. Well, today Ken looks at a situation that seems to provide no way to turn. So what do you do when you hit a dead end? Sometimes what appears to be a dead end is not the end at all, but the beginning of a whole new realm. In just a moment, Kenneth presents part three of the program titled, Going Forward.
Hello everyone, it's good to have you on board in our continuing series, Going Forward. These are thoughts of advancing along the path of life, triggered off by the last verse of Psalm 16, verse 11. You will show me the path of life. There are two major things we are likely to encounter when advancing along the path of life. And we have considered the first category, which is crossroads. That's about which way to go. And they apply to situations where there are alternatives and choices. We are now going to turn our attention to a second category of things that we are likely to encounter as we advance along the path of life. And these are dead ends. And instead of considering which way to go in crossroads, we find ourselves in a strange and perplexing position where there is no way to go. That happens when we face an apparent closing of doors. We get into a rut, as it were, with our back against the wall. It's a situation which we sometimes call an impasse. These two analogies are very familiar to us because our house is located at a minor junction, a minor crossroad, and just a couple of steps further down is a dead end. So if I'm giving you instructions how to get to our house, I will usually use these as landmarks. You follow this road right up to the very end, which is a dead end. And just before that, you turn up left and we're at the next little minor junction or crossroad. And that's where we are. So they can be useful landmarks or signposts to find a location. And a dead end is not all that bad. Occasionally, we hear the screeches of a car, especially in the middle of the night, coming to an abrupt halt when they realize it's a dead end and a no-through road. But other than that, there are all kinds of uses that people find for that cul-de-sac, as a dead end is sometimes also known. We find children playing badminton there, and learner drivers practicing their parking and their three-point turns. And for me personally, what is really attractive about that dead end is what lies beyond. In our dead end, there is a tall fencing with a gate, but which is unlocked, which seems to be designed to keep people out. But beyond that no-through road or dead end is a delightful small stream on the edge of the forest. It's a nice quiet place to go for a little stroll or exercise. In fact, an old couple who used to do some farming had planted a nice and neat vegetable plot in that no man's land. So a dead end is not all that it seems to be. It may be called a blind alley or a no-through road because it apparently leads to nowhere. The dictionary meanings also give two figurative uses of the word dead end. It can be used of being hemmed in by a military force with no way of escape. And we shall look at a biblical example from the Old Testament along those lines. It can also be used figuratively to describe any situation in which further progress is impossible. And we'll look at a New Testament example of that as well. But the natural thing to do when one comes to a dead end is to do a U-turn. But the question to be asked is, What if it is not the end of the road, but the beginning of a whole new realm? In fact, it could be the beginning of a whole new era. And that's the question we shall seek to answer as we look at some biblical examples of going forward and encountering an apparent dead end. First, let us look at a nation at a dead end. This is again the nation of Israel. We're going to look at Exodus chapter 14. We are again going to look at Israel under the leadership of Moses, but going right back to the time when they had just been delivered from Pharaoh and the Egyptians at the first Passover. Now, in just the previous chapter 13 of Exodus, we're given an interesting sidelight in verses 17 and 18, why God did not lead them via a direct way through the land of the Philistines along the coast, but instead caused them to go by a longer way. This is what it says in Exodus chapter 13, verses 17 and 18. Then it came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. So they were led by God through a longer and seemingly roundabout way through the Sinai Peninsula, instead of the more direct coastal route through Philistine territory. And the reason for that is simple. It's because an easy and a quick entrance can likewise spell an easy and a quick exit. And God knew how prone Israel was to turning back at the slightest setback. And in chapter 14 of Exodus, which we are considering, in the very first verse, we find Israel in a location called Pi Hahiroth. Exodus 14:1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. So here we find Israel at a critical juncture when they were encamped at Pi Hahiroth near the sea soon after they fled Egypt on that night of the first Passover. Now, if you're on a leisurely vacation or recreational trip, camping by the sea is a great idea. You can do a spot of fishing, you can have a nice picnic, but if you're a big company of people trying to escape and get away from pursuing enemies, pitching your tents by the sea is not a good idea at all. You do not want to find yourselves hedged in by the fast approaching forces behind you and the sea in front of you, to be caught between the proverbial rock and a hard place, so that you are squashed between the two. That is really a desert kind of analogy. Perhaps a more appropriate expression is one which we sometimes hear, that of being caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. And this was really what Israel found themselves in, as we read in verse 8. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea, beside Pi Hahiroth, before Baal Zephon. Swift on the heels of God's marvelous deliverance at that first Passover comes this abrupt and apparent halt, a virtual about turn, as the hoofs and the wheels of Pharaoh's 600 chosen chariots thundered across the dusty plains. They began to tremble and their faith began to falter. It looks like a situation where they have painted themselves into a corner with their backs against the wall, with no possibility of escape. Now, this can get very confusing and discouraging when you come suddenly and unexpectedly to a dead end, especially after you have just experienced the flush and the momentum of initial success. You thought you're on your way after all the troubles and the agony that you have been through, After the long drawn-out anticipation of deliverance and the opposition from Pharaoh through all the 10 plagues, surely it can't end up like this. Verse 10, And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, Let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. The immediate inference of the natural man is to think that you should not have taken this step. You should not have come this way. The great temptation for the natural man is to blame it on others, and even to blame God. I told you so. But the thing to do is to cross the bridge when you come to it, taking one step of faith at a time. The natural man, in fact, may also be persuaded to go along this way. But what if there is a river with no bridge, or you come to the sea with no causeway in sight? And that is when the reaction and response of the spiritual man differs radically from the natural man. There is a common chorus which is often sung, God will make a way where there seems to be no way. He works in ways we cannot see. He will make a way for me. That is precisely the situation they found themselves in, but with an attitude that only a man of faith can take. And he does this by looking to God alone in faith. There is a precious promise in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, that speaks along the same lines, although with respect to temptation. 1 Corinthians 10:13. Here it is. No temptation, and that word can also be translated as testing. No temptation or testing situation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. Isn't that a wonderfully comforting and assuring thought to realize? That with every testing situation, God always has a way of escape. Just like a teacher who sets tests for the students, it is to prove them in what they should already know if they had been doing their homework or studying for the test. The test is not based on something that is beyond their capability. That's not the purpose of testing, both educationally and scripturally. So with every apparent dead-end situation, God has a way of escape. He will make a way for us if we look to Him. Let's read on in Exodus 14, verse 13. And Moses said to the people, Do not be afraid, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which He will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. Here is Moses' word against theirs. The last thing to do in a state of panic would be to stand still. The flesh is always restless and cries out to do something, anything, but to stand still. On the other hand, fear paralyzes us and freezes us into inaction. Therefore, while the flesh cannot stand still in the face of an emergency, at the same time, fear freezes us into a state of inability to react. But only faith can stand still and see the salvation of God. This is not standing idle or frozen in fear, but it's a steady standing still with unwavering faith to see how God's mighty hand will save and fight for them. It's not a question of whether or not God will save or deliver, but rather of what God will do to save and to deliver. Such an attitude of faith is immortalized in the words of Charles Wesley, Faith, mighty faith, the promise sees, and looks to God alone, laughs at impossibilities, and cries, "It shall be done." Notice that it begins with seeing the promise of God. And then it looks to God alone. That's what standing still and seeing the salvation of God means. When we look at God's promises, and when we look to Him alone, we shall be clothed from on high with a holy boldness that laughs at impossibilities and cries, "It shall be done." This is not just a case of positive thinking, but simple believing. It's not my thinking that makes the difference. It's God's promise and word. Now let us see what is God's word to them through Moses. Verse 15, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward.'" Here is our specific word of instruction from the Lord to go forward. Verse 16, "But lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea." God's word to them was that this is not the time to cry out for help, but to go forward. There is a time to pray, and then there is a time to press on. You remember Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane on the night that he was betrayed. He had spent all night agonizing in prayer, even seeking to involve three of the closest disciples to pray with him, without success. But there came a distinct point in time, at the end of it all, where he said, "Rise, let us be going." There was a time to pray, and there was a time to press on. And this is what God was saying to the children of Israel through Moses. "It's not a time to cry out to me for help. That would simply be a camouflage for unbelief. But now is the time to go forward in faith, in the promises of God. To do anything else would be disobedience and unbelief." Charles Haddon Spurgeon said this, "Man's extremity is God's opportunity." We will not normally or naturally take this route unless there is no choice. And for Israel, this was in fact not the end, but really the beginning of the journeys of Israel. We'll always find that when we are ready to go forward with expectant faith, God will give the specific instructions and show the way, as He told Moses about lifting his rod and stretching out his hand over the sea to divide it. It shall be told us what to do in that very hour. When standing at an apparent dead end, we are prepared and all ready to go forward, standing still and seeing the salvation of God work out. And for Israel on this occasion, they discovered that this was yet another great miracle so soon after the first Passover. Then they had just been liberated from the bondage and slavery of Egypt under Pharaoh, but now this was something more. They had been vindicated so that they were to see their enemies for the last time. There was even greater jubilation in this vindication beyond their liberation. So much so that it led to the great songs of celebration and thanksgiving in the next chapter 15, where we have the song of Moses and the song of Miriam. Adoniram Judson, who eventually became the first American foreign missionary, had a clear call to the mission field. His great interest was kindled when he read a book on the Kingdom of Burma. When he was still studying in seminary, a good family friend of his father had been appointed to be the pastor of the largest church in Boston, Park Street Church, and he specifically wanted Adoniram to be his assistant as soon as he graduated from seminary. And of course, his own father, who was a minister, as well as his mother and sister, were very pleased. But they had to be deeply disappointed when Adoniram turned this down and shared with them his heart's burden and call to the mission field. But when he was finally on his way, having found himself on transit in India, the news and reports came in that it wasn't that feasible an option after all. Moreover, they were threatened with deportation, so that they found themselves on the little island of Mauritius in the middle of the Indian Ocean. He and his wife began to reconsider their options and reset their sights, and concluded that perhaps the British port of Penang off the peninsula of Malaya was a more feasible and practical option, as there were no ships who ever left from Port Louis in Mauritius directly for Penang. They had to make their way again to India, and this time to Madras. While they were waiting in Madras for a suitable ship to bring them to Penang, and finding none, and as the weeks passed by, they grew increasingly concerned about the possibility of repatriation again, being deported back to their homeland. They came to the point where they told the Lord, "Provide us a ship to anywhere except to bring us home." And lo and behold, there turned up an available ship and its destination, Rangoon in Burma. By this time, they had come to regard the mission to Burma with horror, with everybody saying the same thing and having the same opinion: stay away from Burma. But in their desperation, this was the only ship to the only destination, which was God's original destination for him. God often works in ways that we cannot see, but he will make a way for me. And I trust through these meditations, you would have been refreshed by the Lord's presence and reached by his wonderful word.
When we are ready to move forward with expectant faith, God will give his instructions and show us the way. Thank you, Kenneth. This is Times of Refreshing, a ministry of Bethesda Hall in partnership with TWR Asia. And join us again tomorrow for part 4 of Going Forward. Right now, though, we would love to hear from you, and I have several ways through which you can be in contact. You can send us a text message at 9431-3813, or you can write to us at Post Office Box 392, Thompson Road, Post Office, Singapore 915-714. You can go to our Facebook page and leave your comments there or share some views with some of the other folks you see. Also, I invite you to visit our website, www.timesofrefreshing.asia, where you can listen to the program right online. And Times of Refreshing has launched an iPhone app that allows users to directly access the broadcast messages and the podcasts right from their iPhones. I'm McDaniel Phillips, inviting you to join us again for Times of Refreshing.